Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am feeling a little under the weather, as you could tell. So luckily, I have a co-host with me tonight who is over the weather, JB.
I believe when I fall in love with you, it'll last forever.
It will be forever.
Oops, sorry.
Oh, come on.
He's not sick enough to not correct me.
You can find our website at fthismovie.net, where you can find all of our past podcasts. And, you know, if you're only listening to our podcast, just know that you're missing out on, I don't know, 8/10 of our content. There's a ton of stuff at the website that you're missing out on.
Articles and lists and softly whispered affectionate gestures.
You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. You should do that if you haven't already. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And you can find us in the iTunes store by searching fthismovie. And while you're there, if you want to leave us feedback, a review, we always appreciate it. Thanks to everybody who's taken the time to do that already and said some nice stuff. Some people have said less than nice stuff, and that's fine. Listen, be honest,
you know. We have thick skin.
That's right, exactly. So those are all the ways you can find us.
So, Patrick, before we discuss High Fidelity, what have you seen lately?
Oh, goodness. Thanks for asking. A couple weeks ago, a prominent theater here in Chicago that comes up in the movie High Fidelity was running their very own 70mm film festival.
It's the Music Box.
It's the Music Box.
They're quickly getting back in my good graces.
I wasn't going to not name them.
It's becoming the happiest place on earth again.
I didn't want to go hyper-local with the references. They were having their very own, their very first 70mm film festival. So I had a Friday night all planned out. I was going to go see, I forget what the name of the goofy thing that they showed with the skis and the roller coaster. Shoot, it was a short that they shot that they showed in front of Oklahoma for the first time. It was shot in 70mm. This does no good because
it's like a demo thing.
Yeah,
supposed to ape This Is Cinerama.
Basically, yes. And this would be so much more effective if I could remember the name. But they were going to show it during this reception, and that ended up not happening. So then they just tacked it on to the beginning of Vertigo. So I saw Vertigo in 70mm, and I'd actually already seen Vertigo in 70mm. So it's good. It's Vertigo. I don't know. It's great. I think it's still probably my favorite Hitchcock movie. It's probably that or Psycho. It was interesting to see it with an audience of people, many of whom had not seen it before, because as we've discussed before on this podcast, there was nervous or uncomfortable or ironic laughter during the scenes where...
And ironic has quotation marks around it because either the moment was not meant to elicit laughter...
It was not.
Or, in my favorite case... It was, but the audience mistakes it for sort of quaintness or something,
right. So
they're laughing ironically at something that's not ironically funny.
Right. It was more during the end when Jimmy Stewart's really freaking out on Kim Novak, and people didn't know how to process his craziness, and so they just laughed it off. Then my plan was to stick around and see 2001 in 70mm, which I have never seen in a theater. JB, I know you have on a giant screen.
Yeah, it's like, speaking of top 10 lists, which tonight's film involves to a great extent, are actually top 5 lists.
That's right.
It's an American film and we have to keep it short and punchy. I'd say that's in my top 10 movie going experiences. Roger Ebert showed it one year at his Ebert Fest in Champaign, and this word is thrown around a lot, but it was awesome. It was like you had never seen the film before. And I still believe you shouldn't watch that one on TV.
Yeah.
It's like looking at it through a keyhole or studying a stamp with a magnifying glass.
Well, I would have loved to watch it on a big screen at the Music Box. Sadly, about an hour after the start time, we waited for about an hour, and then it turned out that the film was broken, the soundtrack was broken, and so they were not going to screen 2001 after all. So instead,
there were a lot of people in line.
Oh, it was sold out. I mean, there was over 700 people. So instead, they showed the midnight show early, which I had planned to stick around for anyway. So I got to see a new or restored print of Phantom of the Paradise.
One of your favorite movies.
Yeah, if you've listened to my favorite movies podcast, we talk about it on there. And that was great, and I got to see it with an audience full of people who were there to see 2001, and those who didn't walk out stuck around for Phantom of the Paradise, and I probably wouldn't have seen that movie otherwise. That movie may never have been on their radar, so it was neat to be in an audience full of people who were being exposed to this thing that they might not have otherwise been exposed to, and to hear many of them react positively to it. And then I came out of the theater, and there was JB there to see it at midnight.
Because I was expecting to see Phantom of the Paradise with my friend Patrick Bromley, but of course the music box put the kibosh on those plans.
And what was your reaction to Phantom of the Paradise this time around?
Well, like you said, it was the best looking print I had ever seen. I had been used to that movie looking pretty bad. And I think it's interesting because, like the 1931 Dracula and also Night of the Living Dead, the shittiness of it becomes part of the experience to the extent that people were starting to write that George Romero had intentionally made Night of the Living Dead look like that because it was supposed to look like shitty 16mm news footage of the Vietnam War on your nightly news. And when that one company came When Elite put out that Laserdisc, it was like, oh my God, everyone was wrong. And the Dracula restoration on Blu-ray actually made people reassess the film. I had always liked Phantom of the Paradise, but that print was like, wow. It was like it was filmed yesterday, and suddenly you're like noticing things that De Palma did because you're not distracted by nonsense. I've always liked the film. I think I enjoyed it even more this time because besides the great print, I had recently watched Paul Williams Still Alive, a documentary I cannot recommend for various reasons, and at some point it might be a column or something, because the subject of the documentary is fascinating. The filmmaker goes about it in all the wrong ways. In fact, he uses clips from Phantom to illustrate parts of Paul Williams' life, but because he had gotten too close to the subject, he doesn't use the right clips. I'm watching Phantom, and I'm like, well, hell, if you wanted to illustrate that ironically, why didn't you use that? Well, that would have been too mean because Paul's your friend now.
Got it.
But Phantom of the Paradise is amazing, and every time I see it, I carry a couple of the songs around in my head.
Yeah.
For days, insanely catchy music.
Yeah, written by Paul Williams.
Which, of course, was his stock in trade in the 70s because he wrote all these hits for all these different bands and... Wow, he was a tune meister.
It's a great movie. If you haven't seen it, check it out. Not for all tastes, but I think the people that it's for, it's really for. And then a couple days went by, and I did not make it back to see 2001. I did not make it back to see, which was repaired and then shown for the next few days. I did not make it back to see Lord Jim, which is okay, because that movie also didn't get shown.
Two of my students managed to go back and see 2001,
yeah,
and they were properly awed by it. Of course, the ending left them mystified until I explained it to them, and their jaws dropped open, and then I hastily added, you understand, there's no way to get that from the movie. This is based on things I've read
right.
from Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, and that made them feel better. But they really liked the ending once I explained to them what the hell it meant.
So a few days go by, and then midweek, I made it out with JB to a 70mm presentation of Toby Hooper's Life Force.
And I have a lot of affection for that movie, but I think you had a similar experience. I sat there and said, why is this in 70mm?
Yeah, there was 70mm didn't really add anything.
I think it was blown up for certain dates, and it's not as if Toby Hooper's brilliant pictorial compositions or something. I suspect that some people actually came, like, to see her naked better or something.
Really?
That seems to be a big appeal of the film now. On the way to the theater, you and I had been talking that we actually really liked the last hour when all hell breaks loose because it's like this great Hammer film that they never made. And more ironic laughter in the music box, because there's a sequence where in a secret government building, there's a lot of doors. And to get from one place to another...
That did become kind of absurd. I could handle the people laughing. I had more of a problem with the people laughing. There's a scene where the the evil head vampire kind of jumps from body to body, and at one point she's inhabiting the body of Patrick Stewart and sort of drawing Stephen Railsback in for a kiss. And so it looks like Stephen Railsback and Patrick Stewart are about to kiss, and that got lots of laughs.
But I think
two men can't kiss.
But I think the film is aware of that and uses that really well in that sequence.
Yeah.
My point is, I had seen this film 5 or 6 times before, and until the hipster douchebags began to laugh, because they need to be entertained at every minute, it never occurred to me that there were too many doors.
Yeah.
That never struck me.
Yeah.
And the minute they started laughing, that's like all you notice, because then it happens 2 more times. There's a lot of doors in that building.
I had forgotten. It's been a couple of years since I had seen it. It was at one of the sci-fi spectaculars. We saw it a couple of years ago, and that was the last time I saw it. And I had kind of forgotten, because my memory of the movie is it's slow for an hour, and then it goes bonkers for an hour, and that's one of the things I've always liked about it. But I kind of forgot that right up front, it's actually pretty goofy. Like, right at the first 10 minutes, they're finding giant bats in space.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the hell is going on in this
movie? I had
forgotten
the bats in space. I actually, excuse me, I actually forgot Patrick Stewart was in it.
Yeah.
And clearly the first time I saw it, I had no idea who Patrick Stewart was. But I love when that happens, where one of these people makes it big.
Also getting a laugh was at one point they drug Patrick Stewart and they need to wheel him out to a helicopter, an airplane, I don't remember, and they put him in a wheelchair, and as soon as he's in the wheelchair,
oh, yeah,
everybody laughs.
Lots of ironic laughter. And you know that Patrick Stewart has made it because he's the narrator of the Enterprise rent-a-car commercials now. Take any car in the aisle.
All right.
That's a fairly good Patrick Stewart.
I like Life Force a lot. Scream Factory is actually going to put it out on DVD and Blu-ray in April, and I will be buying it. Both cuts of the movie, I found out.
And I forget what month, but they're also putting out your favorite, The Burning.
Yeah, they are.
That's coming out on Scream Factory. I can't wait to see the extras for that.
And I also just found out they're putting out Ninja 3, The Domination.
Oh, boy.
The movie where a dude licks V8 off of Lucinda Dickey's boobs. A formative memory for me. A formative memory. You want to talk about High Fidelity?
JB sits and silently ponders Patrick's obsession with action movies.
V8. Oh, sorry.
I could have had a V8. High Fidelity is a very interesting film. It's a very good film. It's a very, very good film.
Yes.
But I'm going to prevent this from becoming the Chris Farley show by bringing up some things that perhaps aren't that good about it.
Okay.
And seeing whether you agree.
Okay.
Should we start with the big one?
Sure.
I'm going to mispronounce her name.
I could maybe try and help.
Okay, here's the wrong pronunciation.
Okay.
It's certainly not Ibn Hajali.
No.
Ibn Hajali.
I don't even think it's Hajali. I think it's just Yali. But I could be wrong.
Ibn?
Ibn Yali. Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's correct.
Apparently in her native country, she's done much television and movies.
Okay.
This is her sole American film.
Yeah.
Although I discovered on the Wikipedias that she was offered a role in Lord of the Rings and turned it down because she didn't want to be away from home for that long.
I guess I can't blame her.
And I'm not familiar with Lord of the Rings.
She was supposed to be Frodo.
When I first read that would have been a stretch. When I first read that, I naturally assumed it was going to be the part played by Steven Tyler's daughter.
Liv Tyler.
But it's not.
Okay.
It's a word I can't pronounce because I'm not into the whole Tolkien thing.
Okay.
E-O-W-Y.
Eowyn?
Yes.
Got it.
That's the part she was
on. And that gets confusing because I believe the Liv Tyler character's name is Arwen? I might have that wrong, so Lord of the Rings fans, don't crucify me. But yeah, there's an Arwen and an Eowyn.
And
I know
apparently
it ended up played by Miranda Otto, I believe.
I'm impressed.
Yeah.
It was also offered to Uma Thurman.
Interesting.
So this is...
she opted to do My Super Ex-Girlfriend.
So this is... bad choice. This is Ibn Hajali's only American film performance, and I have a problem with it. I think it's a weak spot in the film.
Okay. Watching it this time, because that was one of the things that I was aware of, because it's a movie that's populated by all these familiar faces, except for her.
Yeah.
And she's the female lead, and you wonder, well, what is it about her that they went with her? I actually like her performance.
Okay.
I think it's kind of good casting. I think the fact that she's unknown helps. And I'm not going to be able to articulate it in a way that necessarily explains it for everyone in the audience, but I have known her before, the woman who lives in the city apartment with the hip guy, who's a little bit more together than he is, and I think she gets a lot of it. I don't know. John Cusack has a monologue later in the movie about all the things that he likes about her.
Right.
And I think some of the things he says, I can see in her performance.
The laughter line.
Yeah.
She laughs with her whole body. She's not conventionally beautiful.
Correct.
Although she is very, very striking, very cute.
Yes.
I was wondering if one of the reasons she was cast is because English is not her native language, and in this film she's clearly trying to suppress her accent.
Right.
That it leads to line readings that are kind of unusual and unpredictable.
Maybe.
A bunch of her lines come out in that way that they only come out that way if you don't speak English.
Okay.
But maybe part of this is my bias. I could not for the life of me understand why Lily Taylor wasn't given that part.
I think that would have been a mistake.
Because?
Because I think Lily Taylor already comes with too much baggage, and I think, you know, she acted together with John Cusack in Say Anything, and I think some of that baggage would have come across. And actually, I kind of like the way that she is casted. She's not given much to do. A lot of the smaller, especially female roles, aren't given much to do, although I am impressed at some of the actresses' ability to create a character very, very quickly.
Yes.
And Lily Taylor does a fine job. There's nothing wrong with her performance, but I like that she's this person that he used to know, that he used to date, that he has a past with, that he's not with anymore, because I think some of the Say Anything baggage actually works for that.
And again, I'm just a big fan of Lily Taylor, and if Lily Taylor is not conventionally beautiful, then that certainly can't be the reason that she's not given the lead. I think Ivan Jolly and Lily Taylor should switch parts, although clearly I'm in the minority, which actually at this table I'm not.
Nope.
I'm 50% of the vote
exactly right.
Votes for that. I love the scene where they get back together and he says, "How are you doing?" And she begins with, "Not good." And then there's this litany of things, because I think we've all been in that place. Look, when I said, "How are you doing?" That's the social contract. I was not inviting.
And there's a great moment, too, where there's an awkward goodbye in the doorway and she clearly wants him to come in, and he walks away and he's doing a monologue to the camera and she's just watching him the whole time. It's great.
That's one of my favorite things in the film, when he walks away and says, "I could have just had sex."
Yeah.
But it wouldn't have been good.
I like all the monologue stuff, and Cusack is one of the few guys I think that could really pull it off.
Well, that's my next quibble.
Okay. I would say that sometimes, because the book is written in such a way that it's totally from Rob's perspective and we're in his head 100% of the time. And so, like the Hunger Games, they had a hard time sort of figuring out how to make that work narratively. So they just have Rob narrate to the camera. And at times, especially towards the end, he just flat out says a lot of, "I'm feeling this and I wish this." And so there are things that aren't necessarily dramatized so much as just flat out stated. And that could certainly be seen as a weakness, I think.
I thought there was too much
direct
address to the camera.
Yeah.
Normally, I think any direct address to the camera is like screenwriting 101.
It works very few times.
It's just too easy.
Yeah.
You know, it's the opposite of show, don't tell.
Right.
It's tell, 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 tell. And I agree that Cusack's very good at it, and he's engaging enough to get me interested and make me ignore the fact that I hate this trope. But you're right, towards the end, when the story really gets going, it seems like an interruption. In fact, the other thing I wanted to bring up was, and I had mentioned this to you before we started recording, or maybe days ago, is that I've seen this film many times, and there was a time when I showed it in class. And it's one of the rare films that every time I watch it, the scenes seem to be in a different order, because it is so episodic.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me there were many ways they could have put this film together. Mm-hmm. Does it follow the chronology of the book?
Basically, yeah.
Because at the end, we're suddenly getting this discourse on how to make the mixtape.
Right.
And it really seems the last few times I've seen it, it's like, okay, that should have been earlier to establish what it means when he starts making the journalist from the reader the tape.
That is established earlier, is it not?
Well, that the way that he originally got together with Laura is that right. She came to the club.
But doesn't he describe DJ. The rules for making a mixtape earlier on?
No, that's way late.
Okay.
And this is the phenomenon I'm talking about. Right. Most movies, I remember the chronology.
Right.
This is one of the few films where every time I see it, I'm amazed at where things go.
Yeah.
A good example of this, and it's the other thing I wanted to bring up, you had mentioned that a lot of the female actresses have very little time to establish a character, and they all do a really good job. I mean, Joan Cusack is not in the movie that much.
Mm-hmm.
And another person who's not in the movie that much, and I think this is a testament to his skill, Tim Robbins
mm-hmm.
is only in three scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of amazing when you think, clearly he's mentioned in a lot of
right.
other scenes.
Right.
How's Ray?
Right.
It's three scenes.
Yeah.
It's the fantasy lovemaking, it's the awkward dinner, and it's my favorite scene in the movie. Is it your favorite scene?
It is not, I don't think.
The Tim Robbins character goes to the record store to straighten Rob out, and Rob goes through several permutations of how that could have gone, and it's beautiful filmmaking. Talk about the opposite of show don't tell, that they keep running it back to his same line to establish a chronology. And then horrible things happen with blood and teeth in an air conditioning unit. It's really, really funny.
Yeah, I was noticing that on this rewatch, there's a moment at the awkward dinner where Tim Robbins gets angry for a second at the phone ringing and puts it down and does this little, enhances his calm and then goes back to eating. And it's like, oh, we know exactly who this guy is based on that little moment.
This zen-like moment where right. he gives Laura this little smile and never says it, but it's, I'm okay now.
Right, right. Back in 2000, maybe in 99, my now wife, then she was not my wife, I'm not even sure we were dating at the time, that she gave me this book. And I had never read anything by Nick Hornby. I knew who Nick Hornby was, but she gave me the book to read, and I read it in about 2 days. And it very quickly became maybe my favorite novel of all time, and I know that makes me pedestrian, but I really love it, and there's a lot of reasons why I love it. But a major reason that I love it is because Erica is always kind of going on about, she's a good observer of human nature, of mankind, and she's forever saying there are 30 types. There's basically 30 types of people, and every time we meet somebody or talk to somebody, they kind of, oh, you're just like this person and this person and this person. You fit into this little box. There's 30 types. And not that I ever thought I was a unique snowflake, but I never really knew what my type was. I mean, I knew people like me, but I never really knew I had a specific type, right? And then I read this book, and I think, oh, shit, Nick Hornby has me figured out. I'm this type.
And you're jumping the gun a little bit.
Okay.
Because I... No, we should. We should. That's the perfect intro.
Okay.
I was saving this for the big reveal.
Mm.
You're John Cusack.
Yeah.
In real life.
Yeah.
To a disquieting degree. I'm watching the film through the filter of Patrick.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, there's a couple details that are a little bit different, but... the fetishizing of objects, perhaps not records, but perhaps movies. The relationship between John Cusack and Ibn Hajili, which I've always kind of seen as you and Erica, especially in your courtship, which I know nothing about.
Interesting.
But because I know nothing about, I've placed those scenes from this film in there. But towards the end, when they start talking about the future, that you were this, and I hope you don't mind that I'm saying this.
Okay.
That you were this observer and this critic. And then you decided to produce something. And what you produced is not that skater band, Mother Stole My Wheelchair, whatever it is. What you produced is this.
Yeah.
That F this movie is what you put out into the world. So I'm watching High Fidelity and going, woo!
There are, I mean...
It's you.
I had done a lot of growing up by the time that Erica and I got together, so I didn't necessarily go through.
I would disagree with that. So, go ahead.
Well, what I mean to say is there's the beat where the girl at the record store who writes for the Reader pays him some attention and flirts with him a little bit and makes him feel interesting because he knows something. And men love to be interesting and know something about something. And I could teach you about this.
Yeah.
So he's excited by that. And so he starts making her this tape sort of in secret. And I haven't had, you know, that beat in my relationship with my wife, even when we were dating. But I definitely have been that guy in the past. And I mean, that's getting a little personal and or revealing. But in past relationships, I have definitely been that guy, and I'm not proud of it. And that's one of the things I like so much about this book and this movie is just how real and sort of exposed it is that John Cusack has all these flaws and he's not proud of them, but the movie looks at them very believably.
Very honestly.
Yeah.
The corollary to the scene with the Reader journalist where suddenly it becomes flirtatious is an earlier scene between Rob and his two employees and the black gentleman, where he just lays it out. You have all this knowledge, and you have nothing but contempt for people who don't, and you lord it over them, and that makes you a douchebag. And I'm paraphrasing, but the three of them go, yeah.
Well, again, and that's what is so smart about this movie, is that it uses music, but it has a very specific type of person figured out. And I'm guessing it's the type of person who obsessively collects DVDs and watches movies and loves to organize their collection and make lists of movies that they love and listens to a movie podcast. I mean, they're talking about us.
It makes me sad when Todd Luiso says, it's not alphabetical, is it, with this disdain? Because I've always put things
as have I, but I think that line is really funny, that they're somehow even beyond alphabetical.
And he's very impressed that Rob is going for autobiographical, which of course leads to a situation where no one can find anything except you.
Right.
I once arranged my CDs in color order. So on the wall, it looked like a chroma test strip. I remember being incredulous
when you did that.
From white to yellow to red to green to blue to black. And it was beautiful. Because my feeling was, well, everyone knows what color the spine is. Why would you not? Sergeant Pepper, it's red.
Right.
Anything before Sgt. Pepper is white. And it's not just the Beatles. If you name a CD, I can tell you what color the spine is.
Yeah.
My son and wife were very unhappy with this arrangement. Because literally, whenever they wanted to listen to something, they had to ask me.
Right.
And of course, I, disdainfully,
you are
green.
A gatekeeper, right.
It's green. But I did want to talk about that because I think half of the movie is this movie that has a lot to say about romantic relationships and love, let's just say it. And then the other half of the movie is about record collecting and the idea of collecting. And the John Cusack character even says it at the beginning, I run this business for people who fetishize these things. And again, like you said, I find that interesting because we do the same thing but with movies. That the movie has a lot to say about collections and what it means to collect things.
But also people who live their lives through pop culture. The book goes a little more in depth with other forms of media. I mean, music is first and foremost Rob's obsession, but he talks about a lot of movies and collects a lot of VHS tapes and stuff like that.
And the movie, I think, wisely sort
yeah,
of
definitely,
narrowed
because that
in
would
on.
Get too confusing. But people who live their lives through pop culture, and so they have these conversations about how I want to live life in a pop song. I want a girl to write a song about me. I want to have her make little jokes for me in the liner notes.
And a great song, and I might be in the picture
right in
the background.
And they all get why that's better.
No, that's a terrific scene. That's at Lounge Axe. That's a scene at Lounge Axe.
Yeah.
But hold on a second. I just got to grab my thought. That the John Cusack character even says at one point, we are what we like. We are not how we are.
What you like is not important. Or what you are like. What you like is more important than what you are like. Or
And then he continues to go on about this.
Yeah.
And I thought it was so interesting because, not that I'm being shamelessly self-promotional, I did a column a while ago about Blade Runner where that's the conclusion I reach.
Yeah.
Taste in movies is not one criterion for picking a lover. It's the only criterion.
And we all do it, and we all want to be above it, but we've all been in conversations, again, as obsessive movie fans, and that's one of the things that's so great about the movie, I think, is that you can easily substitute. I mean, it knows a lot about music, and it talks about it in a way where it's knowledgeable and not necessarily trying to impress you with how cool it is.
But my favorite example of that is, and you know the scene, I will now sell 5 copies of
the 5 EPs by the Beta Band. Yeah.
And a worse movie would have some song that the producers made a deal for them to push. The song that Cusack puts on,
it's great.
And everyone in the record store responds. It's just this magical scene because we in the audience are going,
that is really good. Yeah, exactly. And then he says, I know. So it does know a lot about music, but you could easily swap it out for movies or whatever it happens to, whatever you happen to be into, although I will come back to that in a minute. But we've all been in the situation where you're in a conversation with somebody and movies come up and they reveal their taste to be horrible. And it's not that you immediately decide that you want nothing to do with that person, but at least as far as I'm concerned, I know it's shallow and I know it's bad, but I guess this podcast is all about revealing stuff.
And
I
all know about that, being shallow.
I know that it's only going to go so far with this person. I'm only going to be this good of friends with this person. I'm only going to be able to have this many conversations with this person because we are just not on the same wavelength. Doesn't make me better, just different.
The other day, and I'm going to be necessarily cryptic at this point.
All right.
A colleague and I were talking, and I don't know this person very well, and the colleague in question went on and on about going to see Identity Thief and how much the colleague loved it and how much it made them laugh. And I had to force a smile and say, I haven't seen it yet, and leave off and will never see it. And now I'm totally reassessing you as a human being.
Right.
Really, it was a hoot.
And again, one of the things that the movie is great with is that it has these three little archetypes, and they're essentially the same person, but they go about it a very different
variations
way.
On a theme.
Yeah, that you have the Cusack character, and again, he's sort of the one who I identify with, who is obsessed with these things, who lives his life through pop culture, but is still sort of able to function and have relationships and be a person. And then he has these two employees in the store, and one is Dick, and he's played by Todd Luizzo, and he is shy and awkward and almost autistic and crazy obsessed with music to the point where it's made it very difficult for him to interact with people. And then on the flip side of that, you have Barry, played by Jack Black, in a great early performance, who has become a bully.
Yes.
And so in the John Cusack situation, you smile and nod and say, I haven't seen Identity Thief or whatever. But if you're Barry, you tell that person
that they should kill themselves.
Yeah, exactly. You humiliate that person for having such horrible taste. And we've all known that person. And the movie really gets... the first time I saw it, it was like a revelation. Like, oh my gosh, somebody finally got that guy right.
Right. And it's interesting, the contrast between the three. Here's a critical theory that I entertained this afternoon and then abandoned. produced and abandoned. That I'm watching the film and I'm watching the interaction between Dick and Barry and Rob, and it began to occur to me, can you make a parallel here between High Fidelity and, wait for it, Shakespeare's The Tempest? Because in Shakespeare's The Tempest, you have this gentleman who's full of magic, that would be John Cusack, and he has two little helpers that help him. And one of them is Ariel, who's a sprite and goes about things in a very airy, light hard way, and that would be Dick. And then there's Caliban, who's pure animal id. He's this horrible half-beast, half-man. And that would be Jack Black. But at that point, the theory broke down. That's as far as I got. Clearly, as a movie, you can't have the three of them be the same. But I agree with you that they've nailed those two types.
Yeah.
Because I know those two types. One of my favorite Todd Luizzo lines is that he's pushing this new band on Rob, and Rob has said, I will check them out, and he's already made Rob a tape of a previous album and says that he'll tape the new album, and Rob is trying to be very, very polite, and there's this really long, awkward pause that ends with Luizzo saying, I'll tape it for you.
I love all of the Dick and Barry scenes.
And I watched the film, and I shed a tear of nostalgic regret, because record stores were a big part of my childhood, and getting someone to drive you to Rolling Stone Records on Harlem and Irving. It's still there. It's crippled for various reasons. But Rolling Stone Records also had a downtown one that was even more amazing on Washington. I'm guessing it closed. At one point, it became Rock Records. I think they split off, or the two partners squabbled or something. It's where I bought my first bootleg. It's very important. But I'm watching High Fidelity, and I'm having all these wonderful memories of record stores. And, of course, those aren't really around anymore.
Well, it's interesting because even in 2000 when this movie came out, they were already talking about a dead media. But it's, you know, for very niche collectors and people who are really not just into music but into music on vinyl. And, I mean, that's still a thing.
What year did the novel come out?
Not too many years before, late 90s maybe.
So the novel's aware that it's sundown for vinyl.
Yeah, although I think because the novel is English and set in England, I think records were a bigger deal in England even at that time. So it's already fetishizing a media that is gone, but here we are now 13 years later, which is insane. This movie came out 13 years ago. But essentially everything in this movie is obsolete because it's all about an obsession with a physical media. And as we've talked before, that doesn't exist anymore.
And
people don't collect things.
And again, I'm not just weeping for my childhood, because I think record stores served a purpose, perhaps to socialize some people who might have had problems with socialization. You would go there, and it was social, or as social as some people want to get. Here's my point. When I was going to college, I was lucky enough. I went to U of I. And there was a record store in Champaign that was owned by a friend's brother. And it was this magical place. And you would just go to hang out and talk to him and talk to other people who are in the record store. And then you'd feel guilty and you'd buy something. Oh, here's an Elvis Costello picture sleeve single that I don't have yet. Okay. Because college students don't have a lot of money. And I have such warm memories. Name check, Fred Anderson. Fred Anderson's record store, and I'm wondering, young people today, what's taken that place? The internet?
Yeah, I guess.
The internet is certainly a much more efficient way of establishing community, as we've discovered through F This Movie. But again, I shed a tear because I miss record stores, and also I wanted to bring up that you have a sizable collection of DVDs. It's very impressive. I used to. I'm trying to weed it down a little bit because I'm looking to, have less stuff. My students don't see the need to collect anything.
Right.
They want it to exist, and then they want it to disappear.
Right.
So Netflix is fine. And I can't imagine a world without a physical object I can hold in my hand. I don't quite know what that means.
Well, and again,
because High Fidelity is all about the physical object that you can hold in your hands.
It is, but again, it's smart enough to never flat out say as much. I could imagine so many bad versions of this movie where people give long speeches about what it feels like to hold an album and all this nonsense. But the movie, you know, for those of us who feel that way or who have that same kind of obsession, like, you just sort of understand, there's this silent understanding that, like, this movie gets me.
Although, again, as one who was really into music at an earlier stage in my life, I would have sort of appreciated a monologue about how it feels. And how about this, if you really want to get scary? You want to get scared?
Of course.
How they smelled.
Sure.
When you open them,
there
was a very unique smell. Yeah. And the way record stores smelled.
Right.
Or the way record stores sometimes smelled, because they were owned by dirty hippies.
Right.
Oh, that's patchouli. but I even remember that. What do you think about the way the film navigates the fact that it's really two different things sort of brought together. There's very definitely a feeling that although the film makes some effort to combine them, there's the record music stuff, and then there's the plot, which is about
Oh, I think those two things are completely intertwined, because I think it's all about Rob's inability to grow up. And all of those things are intertwined. I mean, his inability to let go of the past, his inability to be selfless. I think his whole collecting mentality is just... or his record collection is sort of this metaphor for his inability to...
Literally his baggage.
Right, his baggage, exactly. And so I think they're definitely sort of inextricably tied. One of the things I like so much about the movie, and I like romantic comedies, and this definitely feels much more like a romantic comedy that is sort of more for men. Not that women can't enjoy it, because Erica really loves this movie, and so everybody can like a movie. But a lot of men feel like when they go to romantic comedies, oh, this is just for women, and I don't feel like this one is. Because it understands a very specific type of male. So it's nice to be understood every once in a while in a movie. But one of the things I like about the movie is the way that it's both sort of a traditional love story in terms of the guy and the girl get together in the end, but it's also this very long sort of postmortem on that same relationship, what went wrong in this relationship, and it's about putting the pieces back together.
But because of that, I think, first of all, I have to disagree with you that when I watch the film, it's very much a film of pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, I like the record store music stuff a lot more than the romantic relationship stuff.
Okay.
I agree that the film tries mightily to combine them. You were saying that the record collection becomes his metaphor, a really wonderful, subtle metaphor. And again, that brings up another great Todd Luiso scene where he comes by Rob's place to take him to a show, and all of Rob's records are out.
It's the same scene when he's reorganizing.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
And the first time Luiso sees him on the floor, it's like, oh, like he came into the room and Rob was getting an anal exam. Like it was that.
Right.
That he knows what this means.
Right.
I have a problem calling this a romantic comedy.
Okay.
Is it a romantic comedy because they, spoiler alert, they do get back together at the end?
Because it's about relationships and it's comedic.
But only partially comedic.
Sure.
Because
are a lot of things we call a romantic comedy.
When I watched it again, maybe I'm reacting to romantic comedies the last 10 years, which I'm on record that I really hate them and I wish Hollywood would stop making them until they learn to make them again. But I can't remember another romantic comedy with more serious stuff in it.
Okay.
A lot of the pain in this film is very real and not presented comedically. At one point, Laura's father dies, and that's presented, you know.
And John is tough. Mother wouldn't matter, really was. Brother wouldn't matter, really. And John is tough.
Oh, yeah. That's really a wonderful example of him being a dick. But the scene in church during the wake where Laura breaks down, actually, I think that's terrific acting on her part. It's very real. It doesn't seem movie real. It seems real. And I'm not saying to call something a comedy, I have to laugh nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
But would you at least admit that this is a bittersweet comedy?
Oh, definitely. And that's probably one of the reasons I love it so much. Look at, a lot of people consider, like, The Apartment the best romantic comedy ever made, right?
And that's got...
And that's what that movie is all about. That was Billy Wilder, Sour in the Sweet. So I think it could still apply, but I absolutely agree that it has so much honest pain in it. And there's a scene where... Cusack is asking Ivan Yali if she's had sex with Tim Robbins yet, and she says no, and he feels better. And then he comes back a little bit later and asks her the same question. She says, do you want me to lie, or, you know, you don't want to know the answer. Whatever. He says, I want you to tell me you didn't, and I want it to be true. And she says, well, I can't tell you that. And the look on his face is one of pure pain, and then he gets up and walks out. And that's so true, and again, not to be too revealing about myself, but I've definitely been in that situation where I've broken up in a relationship And sometimes it was even my idea, but your ego is such that the thought, not just of her moving on, but of somebody else getting to do something intimate that only you used to get to do, is so hard to take. And it's all about, it's silly, but it is. It's all
it's
a
very
blow
honest.
To an ego.
It's very honest, and it speaks to men's narcissism.
And that movie nails that moment.
And this might be a tribute to Cusack's performance, just completely paints him as a hypocrite.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Given the way he conducts himself while they're broken up. So maybe one of the lessons of this is that more recent romantic comedies are trying so hard to be frothy and likable and really, really funny that if I think about romantic comedies I like The Apartment or Annie Hall or even When Harry Met Sally, there are elements to the film that aren't ha-ha, jokey-jokey joke.
Right.
And maybe partially, the only recent romantic comedy that comes to mind, because I skip most of them, is Bridesmaids. Mm-hmm. The Bridesmaids was really afraid of serious stuff. Again, we had commented before that it seems like there were a lot of hands on that script. But we all agreed that the best scene in the movie is when she makes that cupcake for herself. And that's what that movie needed more of.
Definitely. That the really good romantic comedies understand some sort of truth about not just relationships, but us in relationships. And so many Hollywood romantic comedies invent problems, and it's like, do you expect audiences to identify with the problems that you have invented, that these characters, I have to go catch that plane before she flies away? And it's something that none of us can relate to. It's manufactured drama, and something like High Fidelity finds honest drama in everyday situations.
And as much as I can understand Cusack wanting this part, he co-wrote the script. I think he's one of the producers, because it is a wonderful showcase for an actor. He's in almost every scene. He gets all these monologues. By the same token, I also really admire the fact that the character he's playing is almost not sympathetic, and I would argue wouldn't be sympathetic if John Cusack was not playing
it. I agree with that. I absolutely agree with that. And reading the book, I think it's the same thing. And the only reason I end up sympathizing with Rob in the book is because I see so much of myself. But also, you know, you end up liking him just because he says funny things and he has neat taste and he's honest about himself. So there are things that engender us to him, but I absolutely agree. If another actor had played Rob, we would be saying he's a sociopath.
But when I love when the Catherine Zeta-Jones character, and she's perfectly cast in this movie.
We have to talk
movie.
About her for a second.
As Miss Facile, when he finally broaches the question, why did you break up with me to go out with that guy? And part of her response is, he was sunnier, a little perkier, a lot less work.
Catherine Zeta-Jones in this movie, and you get one of two Catherine Zeta-Jones that show up. she's just this generic, she's the lead in this movie, or she's overacting, or you get this one who's really interesting and almost like a character actress. And in High Fidelity, she's, again, one of these actresses who does so much with so little time, and again, really nails a very specific kind of person who, if you're infatuated with this person, everything she does is cute and unique and interesting and bigger than life.
And then later.
And then as soon as you figure it out, everything about her is awful.
Yeah.
And I love the scene where Cusack figures that out.
I finally figured it out. She's awful.
Right. And nothing about her changes.
She never stops talking. Right. She does this. It's a litany of complaints.
Right. Every scene where he talks about her, though, is funny, where he can't believe her name is in the phone book, or he's not ready to confront her yet. I mean, everything she does, I think, is really good in the movie.
And speaking, again, before we leave this topic about how good Cusack is, I'm thinking of the scene where Laura sits down with the mutual friend, played by Joan Cusack, John's sister, which led me to believe for a while, because she's played his sister in so many movies, that in this she's his sister, but she's not. She's a mutual friend.
Yeah.
And Laura reveals the four things wrong with their relationship. And it's not movie cute things. It's real. I mean, real shitty stuff.
Right.
And I think Joan Cusack's reaction, she keeps making this face, is our reaction too.
Yeah.
And we're not used to seeing that in Hollywood films.
And the movie withholds that information for about 45 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
And so you're really on Rob's side, because right at the beginning, you feel for him because he's just been dumped. Then you get the information that she's banging Ian. And so, oh, that slut, you know, that two-timer. And then about 45 minutes in, all of a sudden, Cusack gets on a bus and confesses the four things.
And after that scene, it's like, Cusack, you got some heavy lifting to do.
Absolutely.
Because this does not paint you in the greatest light. Speaking of the greatest light,
yes.
Ooh, how rare is a good transition? It's recent that this came out on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Because I finally spun the Blu-ray, and there's a preview on it for Frankenweenie,
because
it's both Disney. But the Blu-ray looks astonishing.
Yeah.
There's a couple, in fact, maybe you know this. Were some of the interiors done in California?
Not that I know of. It's possible, but
the restaurants and the record store, the interiors, look suspiciously set-like.
Okay.
And of course, every time they step outside, it's obviously Chicago.
And it's another reason to love the movie if you live in Chicago, because it's a movie that's all over Chicago that's never rubbing your face in Chicago.
They get the details right, yeah. And there's a shot outside the music box that's just a postcard to the music box.
And inside the music box.
Yeah, but again, I'm just talking about pictorial composition.
Oh, yeah.
But here's my point. Near the end of the film, there's a scene of Rob on the bridge. It's the scene you were talking about earlier where he enumerates what he loves about Laura, her smell. And on the Blu-ray, it is just stunning.
Yeah.
Almost, but not quite to an obnoxious degree where it's like, look, it's the Hancock building behind him. That's the way they chose. It never quite reaches that level. But you know the shot I'm talking about.
Sure.
On the Blu-ray, it's amazing looking.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm excited that they took the time to put the movie out on Blu-ray, because I really love this movie.
And it's also available on some DVD compilation. They've been putting out double features lately.
Yeah.
Not just on Blu-ray, although that's new. There's a thing coming out, Casablanca and the African Queen, and I think that devalues the merchandise.
I tend to agree. I'm a weirdo where if I can get a movie by itself, I would rather do that, even though, you know, double features realistically conserve space.
There's a thing coming out, it's Blu-ray, Ben-Hur and Ten Commandments, for the next time you have 6.5 hours available to watch some biblical epics. I wish someone would tell Hollywood, I think it devalues the merchandise.
Yeah.
It... and now we'll give you four. And are we looking desperate yet? Because we're afraid physical media is going away. Speaking of physical media.
Yeah, but again, as Adam Risky pointed out in his column, like, that's a selling point for a lot of people. Look, I can get four movies for $8, and so what if I only want one or maybe two of them? Now I'll own all of the Three Ninjas movies, you know? I just wanted the one, but...
The only reason it appeals to me, because recently Best Buy had a big display, is the space issue.
Right.
Because some of us are running out of space.
Right.
But on some of these quadruple features that are on one Blu-ray, it's exactly what you just said. Three of them are really good. One of them's shitty.
Right.
I'm not buying that because that, you know, that's what kind of a purist you are.
Yeah.
Also, maybe this has something to do with grabbing things for school. I want the movie to be the one thing.
Right.
This is this.
Right.
Oh, I'm like paraphrasing Robert De Niro.
Sickness, but yeah.
I'm paraphrasing Robert De Niro in The Deer Hunter. You see this? This is this. This isn't anything else. This is this. Only I'm not holding a bullet like he does in the movie. I'm holding a Blu-ray disc because I'm just sad.
Also on the Blu-ray are some deleted scenes with a subplot that's in the book and cut out of the movie where Rob, the start of it ends up in one scene where he answers a phone and says, oh, give me the address. And that cuts to him going to see, I believe in the movie, it's Beverly D'Angelo, has this woman whose husband, I believe, has died, and she has all these records, and she doesn't know what to do with them. And there's a lot of it in the book, because Rob discovers a lot of them are really valuable, and so then it becomes this crisis of conscience. Do I take advantage of this woman who doesn't care about these at all? Or do I do the right thing? And again, that's sort of what this whole movie is about his decision to do the right thing, his gradual understanding of what the right thing is.
When my wife's mother passed away, we had an estate sale. Because what do you do? And we hired this woman to run the estate sale. And during the course of her doing her job and setting up the estate sale, she discovered that there were these coins that had some value. And she did some research, and she found a place to sell them. And she told us this, and it meant a lot more money from the estate sale. And I gave her so much credit, because exactly what you're talking about with the Rob character, she could have very easily said, oh, in my experience, these are worthless. I'm just going to take them home and let my kid play with them.
Right.
And we would not be any of the wiser. But that brings up the final point I wanted to talk about in terms of this movie. That it is speaking to me on the older side and you on the younger side in terms of the collection. What happens to the collection when you die?
Yeah.
Do some of us secretly feel that our children will be very excited to have this stuff? And there are even older people on the Classic Horror Film Board, which I recommend, who are in their 60s and 70s and have bigger monster collections than I do and have said, I'm going to die and someone's going to throw this out.
Yeah.
Even the stuff that could conceivably fetch some serious money on eBay. Yeah. Our collections are other people's.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dump it.
Absolutely.
So on that on that happy note.
On that happy note. I don't know. Is it so do you start getting rid of it while you're still alive to save the other person?
That's my plan. In fact, I've told you what my plan is down the road. But I look at my students and I think, you know, their collection is on their phone.
Right.
That's all their music.
And that's where things are going.
And maybe some movies. And then right now, as if you can see me, I'm holding up an iPad, and this will hold a couple thousand songs and a couple movies, and maybe this will be the collection, and then at least your children will have an easier job carting it around.
But what is it about us that we don't want all of our collection on just a single tablet, that we like to handle each individual thing, that when I want to watch a movie, I know I get to go down to the basement, seek it out, pull it off the shelf, take it out. I like that routine.
And that's my question for those of you who have made it to the end of this podcast. What is it about us? Is it the way we were raised? Because clearly younger people, at least the young people I encounter, and I encounter a lot of young people, do not have that collector's mania at all. And I even think books are going to go that way, because now you have the Kindle and iBooks and the and the Nook. What is it about a certain generation of men who collect? I don't know why.
Yeah.
I'd like some of our listeners to weigh in.
I definitely think it's something innate, because as much as I could say it's the way we were raised, I have three siblings who have no interest in collecting.
Could it be brain chemistry? Is it, as my wife has sometimes suggested, a mild form of autism?
Yeah. I mean, that's what my wife says all the time, too. And again, that's one of the things that I like that the movie gets. And what the movie gets, too, is that the record store becomes a magnet for these people. And so now,
which is what I miss about record stores.
Right. But like you said, that this podcast became, maybe this is my record store, I don't know, because I'm not saying it's a magnet for autistics, but it's certainly a magnet for like-minded people, you know, that Adam Risky writes a column about, here's all these reasons why you buy stuff you don't even want, and a bunch of people chime in like, yeah, I've done that and that and that, and what about this one? And everybody just reads it and kind of gets it. Yep, been there.
A year or two ago, I wrote about DVD packaging.
Yeah.
And how irregular DVD packaging drives me crazy.
Yeah.
And people chimed in.
Right.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Because there are 30 types.
One thing that you just said really surprises me, because my memory is, before you settled on F This Movie, the name of the blog was going to be Magnet for Autistics.
That was just our domain name. But it was .net, unfortunately. Still couldn't get the .com. Anyway, thank you guys.
Yeah, some rich douchebag is sitting on magnetforautistics.com.
Making a mint. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you haven't seen High Fidelity, it's weird that you listen to us spoil the whole thing, but
it's a must-see,
you
folks.
Definitely have to see it.
It's something.
It's a great movie, and we will see you guys next week.
Bye-bye.